From the Moen Broadcast Center, this is Take Two, me Martinez. While one part of LA was gathered together in downtown celebrating the Lakers winning a championship, another group of Angelinos were across town trying to bring attention to a deadly border battle happening on the other side of the world. Plus, find out why, while LeBron James was bringing home that title to LA, his social media feed was all about voting. It's ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez, coming up. The Lakers, yeah, they took it all last night, but LeBron James was not crowing about the championship on Twitter last night. I mean, he could have. Instead, he was encouraging people to get out the vote. More on that just ahead. But first, while many Angelinos stormed Staples Center downtown last night to celebrate the Lakers, thousands of others were marching in Beverly Hills in support of Armenia.
I don't want peace.
Shame on Turkey.
Shame on Azeri.
They were rallied around the Turkish consulate to draw attention to Armenia's war with Azerbaijan. Los Angeles Times reporter Lila Seidman was there. Lila, can you help set the scene for us? Who was there and what was the energy like?
Sure thing. Thanks so much for having me. Sure. So, driving to the protest, which actually started at Pan Pacific Park in mid-city, I began seeing cars with Armenian flags waving all the way in Silver Lake, and I kept seeing the drive time increasing on my phone. So it dawned on me that this was going to be a big protest. When I arrived, I realized it was going to be really, really big. Even from the ground, I could tell there were thousands of people. Throngs of people were crossing the street waving Armenian flags, which are red, blue, and sort of a golden orange. And like other protests, the crowd was multi-generational, parents, grandparents, children, and groups of friends in their teens. I would say the energy was almost triumphant. The feeling of solidarity and mutual support was really palpable. But then at times that was broken by heavier emotion. Armenians see this as an existential threat to their people. So there is an underlying solemnity and seriousness in the words that people are saying and the signs that you see. And, you know, that came out from time to time.
Lila, the LAPD's Wilshire station tweeted out that the crowd had reached 100,000. Does that sound right to you?
It's really hard to tell from the ground. It's always hard to pin down the exact crowd size. I spoke to a Beverly Hills police officer on the ground who told me 35,000. Okay. I mean, that's a pretty staggering number. But I did see the LAPD tweet. And when I called LAPD, they said they don't give out demonstration crowd numbers. So that was just an individual police station that tweeted that. But there was certainly a lot of people there.
Yeah. Now, what did you hear from the protesters who turned out? Did anyone's story resonate with you in particular?
Yes, I spoke to people there. They were all very passionate and thankfully very willing to speak with me. There was one protester. His name was Arutyun Kadzikian, who is 56 years old. And he's a native of Armenia, but he's been living here for 30 years. And telling me about his strong connection to Armenia, even after all these years here, he began crying. And I've had this experience with other protesters. He felt a very strong connection to his homeland. And many in the diaspora here see the contested region as part of Armenia. It is populated by majority ethnic Armenians. So there is a very personal connection to this.
All right, that's Lila Seidman, reporter for the LA Times, who was on the scene of the protest outside the Turkish consulate in Beverly Hills. Lila, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
All right, now to help us put the protest in context, we're joined by Liana Akhajanian. She's an Armenian-American journalist who writes about the issue of diaspora. Let's talk about the significance of this protest, Liana, and others that we have seen over the past few weeks. For Angelinos who are just catching up on this, what should they understand about why so many people in LA are turning out for these rallies?
Sure. Thank you for having me. So Armenians really view this escalation of the conflict as a matter of life and death, and frankly, as their continued presence on the lands that they're indigenous to. And so in terms of global population, we only number about 10 million, and we're largely spread out across the world because of the Armenian genocide. And so even one life that is lost is too many, whether that's on the front line or civilians, and certainly both have happened in the last 2 weeks. So this is a motivating factor, and this coupled with the fact that the U.S. government and other governments around the world have had a quite lukewarm response or lack of response, as well as the lack of mainstream media coverage, is really what's fueling people to be coming out on the streets.
Yeah, and this is not just happening in L.A. I live near Glendale. Glen Oaks Boulevard has had some protests and also some marches as well. So it's all over the city of Los Angeles. So give us some insight into the daily experience of Armenian Americans in L.A., especially those who have family in Nagorno-Karabakh or Artsakh, who are at risk. What are they going through right now?
Armenians are feeling very frustrated, angry. I would say the level of anxiety is probably at an all-time high. And I think many feel that, you know, this is another generation who has to experience another form of war trauma. It seems to be a continuous cycle and a fight to just exist and survive. And so I think for many people, it feels like a very far away conflict. But for Armenians, because we're such a small community, it's closer than ever. For example, my entire social news feeds are full of obituaries and tributes to people who have died. And so the degrees of separation between what's going on thousands of miles away and someone physically being in Los Angeles is very, very small. And I think a lot of people are feeling very abandoned by world powers, by the media, by just silence. And they want more people to speak out. And I think the fact that this conflict, this renewed conflict, has new players involved. Certainly, we've seen reports with evidence coming out of Turkish-backed Syrian mercenaries who are fighting for Azerbaijan in the region. And the fact that the cities and villages in Artsakh have been pretty much obliterated, it's magnified that anxiety and that anger to an incredible level. And I think it's changed a lot of people and how they view things and how they're going to engage with their identity in the future.
You mentioned how there's a feeling of being alone for Armenian Americans in LA because everything is so far away. But how much of this also has to do with, for so many decades, Armenians in the United States have been talking about the genocide, but it seems like no one, until maybe recently, has listened. How much of that is going into the emotion that we're seeing over the last few weeks?
Yeah, certainly that plays a huge part. I think history has taught Armenians that they really can only rely on themselves. And I think this is just another example of that continuous cycle. As long as Armenians have been a part of Los Angeles, they've been advocating for genocide recognition. And obviously, those issues are still ongoing. And so that is playing heavily into the minds of diasporans who are protesting and mobilizing for this effort.
You know, over the past few days, you've tweeted about how quickly the Armenian community has mobilized since the war. Can you tell us more about that power of mobilization? What's happening on the ground?
Yeah, it's actually at a level that I haven't seen. Certainly, Armenians are not strangers to protesting and organizing, but there have been organizations all across the U.S. as well as internationally who are raising funds, who are protesting on the streets, doing activist movements everywhere from Paris to Brussels to South America to Beirut to Sydney. So it's seeing that collectively is quite powerful. And in terms of monetary power, I believe that diasporans across the world, as well as other Armenians, have raised about $100 million to send in humanitarian aid to Artsakh at the moment. So when you kind of see all that going on in the world, it really does encapsulate the true meaning of the word diaspora.
We've heard of Armenian Americans traveling there to assist in the war effort. Can you give us any insight into that motivation and that experience?
Yes. So the Armenian mindset right now is that this is just the latest in a series of existential threats that bring with it irreversible harm. And so Armenia is a small country. Artsakh is even smaller. regardless of its size, it's been a cradle for Armenian culture and history for thousands of years. And Armenians have lost so much in their history. And I think, simply put, many diasporans feel that they don't really have a choice, that they have to go because, again, history has taught Armenians that they can only rely on themselves. And like I mentioned earlier, it really does feel like a matter of life and death for a lot of people. And so some people are raising money, some people are protesting, and yes, there have been many people who have left their comfortable homes in across the diaspora and gone to help on the front lines, whether that's in terms of medical aid or actually enlisting.
You know, taking a step back, thinking about the history of the Armenian diaspora in Southern California, what's the significance, would you say, of this moment? Have there been similar periods of tension and mobilization, or is what we're seeing and hearing right now unprecedented?
In a lot of ways, it is unprecedented. Armenians do have a history of mobilizing for greater causes like this. Of course, we previously talked about the Armenian genocide as being one of them, but for things like, you know, in 1988, when there was a devastating earthquake in Armenia, that was a huge mobilization that the diaspora undertook. And of course, when the conflict began in the 90s as well. But this time it feels different because I think one of the aspects of that is that there's a new generation and they're extremely tech savvy and very passionate about discovering their roots. And they're very organized and skilled. And they have taken this to a new level from their online digital organization, their hashtag usage, to emailing journalists. And so they have added a new level of mobilizing for Armenians. It's really significant because, you know, the diaspora is a very complex community. It's complicated and there are so many layers and identities. I think that this has really laser focused everyone on efforts on getting help because the threat feels so clear. And it's very present for everyone that if we don't do something, that we have a lot to lose.
That's Liana Akhajanian, Armenian-American journalist who writes about issues of diaspora identity. Liana, thank you very much.
Thank you.
More Take Two coming up in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm Amy Martinez. Mail-in ballots have been sent out to all 1.7 million registered voters in Orange County. And when filled out and signed, those ballots can be dropped off at any of the 116 collection boxes throughout the county. There will also be more than 150 vote centers where people can drop them off in person starting October 30th. This weekend, however, there were a number of reports of unofficial ballot boxes being set up around the state by the California Republican Party, and some of those are in Orange County. For more on that and other election-related news, we turn now to reporter Nick Gerda. He joins us most Mondays for the OC Update to discuss the major headlines coming out of Orange County, and he's with the nonprofit news site Voice of OC. Now, Nick, just hours ago, the Orange County District Attorney announced an investigation into those vote boxes. What more can you tell us about them and this investigation?
Yeah, so this centers on these unofficial ballot drop boxes, which have been set up by Republican Party officials in Orange County and other counties in around the state. The one that's getting a lot of attention in Orange County was tweeted out by a regional field director for the California GOP who's based in Orange County, and he tweeted a photo encouraging people to drop off their ballots at a tall metal box with a printed piece of paper on it saying that it's an official ballot drop-off box, but election officials in Orange County are saying that it is not an official drop box, and the state's now saying it is illegal to set up unofficial drop boxes, especially if they're marked as being official. And then just a few hours ago, the Orange County DA under Todd Spitzer is announcing they're investigating and looking into whether they'll be filing criminal charges. They say there's been several unofficial boxes placed in at least two Orange County cities.
Now, the California GOP has defended putting those boxes out. What have they said, and what's been the response by election officials?
Yeah, so the GOP has been pointing to a 2016 law that California passed, which legalized having campaign volunteers collect ballots from voters and turn them in. It's what the GOP is calling ballot harvesting. And the Republican Party has been very critical of it for the last few years. They say it makes ballots vulnerable to fraud. But the difference there that the state's pointing to is that law requires that the person collecting the ballots sign for them when a voter hands them over. And what the state and local election officials are saying is that these unauthorized boxes would not be in compliance with that provision. And they're saying it's illegal to claim to have an official drop box when it's not a box set up by election officials that has security measures.
Now, because these ballot drop-off boxes vary in appearance from county to county, describe for us real quick, Nick, what the official ballot drop-off box looks like in Orange County.
Yeah, folks may have seen some of these just driving around. They're these gigantic yellow and white metal boxes that have the county's official seal on them. That's what officials say is something to look out for to make sure it's for real. And they're required to follow strict rules for security to prevent tampering with ballots and to make sure that there's a clear chain of custody for all ballots. There's an official map, interactive map of all of these on the County Registrar Voters website at ocvote.com.
All right. So we're going to dig in more on the legality of these boxes coming up in just a few minutes. Let's go move on to another election story. And that's the current vice chair of the Orange County Board of Supervisors, Andrew Doe, in a pretty tight race for a seat. Tell us about the opposition and why this race is so contested.
Yeah, this is really considered one of the hottest, most competitive races in Orange County this election. It's for the first district seat on the powerful OC Board of Supervisors. They oversee public health during the pandemic, as well as a variety of other things like how to spend public dollars on law enforcement versus health, et cetera. And that district is centered on Central Orange County, Santa Ana, Garden Grove, Westminster, part of Fountain Valley. The incumbent is Andrew Doe, a Republican whose biggest support is coming from the Orange County Sheriff's Deputies Union. And he's running in a district where Democrats have a 17-point advantage in voter registration. So it's expected to be a very tight race. His opponent is Sergio Contreras, a Democrat who's on the Westminster City Council. And Contreras' support is largely coming from trade unions and other organized labor groups.
What are the major issues each person's running on?
Yeah, so coronavirus and homelessness have really emerged as the two big issues in the race. Doe says he's led the county towards safely reopening businesses during the pandemic. Contreras says Doe and the other supervisors have failed in responding to the crisis by undermining public health experts. On homelessness, Doe says he's been really solving the issue and wants to continue doing so. But Contreras says the county has really failed to move fast enough to create affordable housing to get people off the streets.
All right, now to muddy the waters even more. State officials have launched a money laundering investigation into Doe. So, Nick, what's going on here and what kind of shadows is cast on the race?
Yeah, so this was announced last week. State authorities with the Fair Political Practices Commission have launched a money laundering investigation into Doe, focusing on whether he illegally steered over $22,000 last month to his own campaign through the Orange County Republican Party. Doe so far has declined to comment, as has the local OCGOP. Doe's campaign treasurer previously admitted to a prior money laundering scheme and agreed to a $40,000 fine as part of that. And now Doe's opponent, Contreras, and the Democratic Party are saying this speaks ill of Doe's character, and they claim he's corrupt and that people shouldn't vote for him. But so far, no official reaction from Doe's camp.
All right, one more thing, Nick, before we let you go. I wanted to catch up on some coronavirus-specific stories. On the show, we've been talking about this new equity measure counties have to meet to move forward with reopening, and it appears that Orange County is not too happy about it. So in about a minute, Nick, remind us what it is and why the county is pushing back.
Yeah, so this all goes back to the reality that a lot of the working class Latino communities in Orange County are being hit extra hard by COVID, particularly in Santa Ana and West Anaheim. A lot of essential workers, a lot of denser housing there that makes it a higher risk for COVID spread. And the new state metrics say that counties cannot advance to more reopenings further down that tiered list until they bring down coronavirus transmission. In these harder hit communities to be more similar to the rest of the county. And Orange County supervisors are really railing on this. They're saying it's getting in the way of reopening Disneyland and other businesses. And they say they've already done a lot to improve COVID transmission in these most impacted areas. So they see it really as the state, moving the goalpost and getting in the way of further business reopenings.
That's Nick Gerda, reporter with the nonprofit news site Voice of OC. Nick, thanks a lot. See you next week.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, as we just heard, unofficial ballot boxes have been popping up around the state, some placed by Republican officials. At the same time, President Trump has been encouraging his supporters to go to the polls to watch things carefully, with Trump's son, Donald Trump Jr., telling people in a Facebook ad to join their, quote, army. These issues raise concerns about fraud and intimidation. So to help us explain what people can do and cannot do at the ballot box and polling places, we have Justin Levitt, professor of law at Loyola Marymount University, where he specializes in constitutional and election law. So, Justin, regarding those unofficial ballot drop boxes, state election officials have declared them prohibited, but the state's Republican Party argues that they're legal under California's so-called ballot harvesting law. Justin, for those just joining us, can you elaborate on what the law says and whether you believe it applies here?
Yeah, sure. So the law says that anyone in California can collect ballots from anyone else and can turn them in. That's a service that they provide. But you can't pretend to be somebody else when you do it. You can't pretend that your unofficial cardboard box is an official election official drop box. That is, as long as I say who I am and why I'm collecting your ballot, you can choose to trust me or not. But when I defraud you, when I claim to be something I'm not, like claiming that a Dropbox is an official Dropbox when it's not, that's actually not only a big problem, that's a potential felony.
So, Justin, what are the limits then of that law? So, for example, so say I go to my neighbor's house, say they're elderly, and I offer to drop off their ballots for them. Or say I host a voting party and I tell my guests that they can leave their ballots with me and I promise I will mail them or drop them off.
Mm-hmm. 100% fine. Hmm. So as long as you're not intentionally sending out to confuse or mislead people, they can determine whether they want to trust you or not. Your neighbor or the people attending your party can decide, you know what, I trust this guy. Sure, here, take my ballot. Thank you for your help. Or they can decide, you know what, I'm not interested. I'd rather return it myself. So the law allows for anybody to render a service to somebody else, but it prohibits defrauding somebody in the rendering of that service. So if I say, don't worry, I'm going to return this to the elections office for you, and then I throw it out, or I put it somewhere else, or I pretend to you that I'm an officer of the state when I'm not, that's not okay. And very clearly not okay.
Once though, say I have the ballot and something happens, I lose it, or I somehow destroy it. It gets, something happens and the ballot's ruined. How much of a legal liability do I have there?
You're in a fair amount of trouble, particularly if you intentionally did something to that ballot. Right. So setting out to tamper with or interfere with the vote is a crime in California and everywhere else. And if you did something untoward to that ballot, knowing that you'd be disqualifying the person, you're in a fair amount of trouble. Mistakes obviously happen, and occasionally mistakes happen in this process too. And that's part of why the ballot collection laws are permissive. They allow me to put my trust in you as long as I know what you're planning to do with the ballot. I can take that risk, or I can decide I'm not interested in that risk and return the ballot myself.
Justin, so just to be clear, so if Republicans put out boxes saying they're made by Republicans, that's okay.
Yeah. If Republicans wanted to stand by the side of the road with boxes or put out boxes to stand by the side of the road that says California GOP drop box here, insert your ballot, we'll get it returned to the elections office. I don't actually think there's any problem with that. That's not what I'm hearing out of the reports in Orange County and elsewhere. The pictures that have showed up online claim that these boxes are official ballot drop boxes. That implies that they are authorized by the state or local government. And it doesn't say that they're California GOP drop boxes anywhere. And that attempt to mislead voters into thinking they're depositing a ballot with the official entity of the county or state, and they're not, that's the thing that's going to cause a real problem with potentially some criminal consequences for the people who put the plan together.
And if you're unsure about the Dropbox you plan to use, here's a way to truly find out if it's official. The fake ones so far appear to be only in English, the ones placed by actual county election officials. We'll have more information on them in multiple languages, including English, Spanish, Chinese, Thai, and more. Plus, they'll have your county seal on it. But Justin, what's the best way for listeners to report a box that they suspect is not official?
The best way to actually ask any question, including is this box official or not, is to contact your local county registrar. The counties are staffing up to be able to deal with a lot of questions in this period. And so every county's got their own website and their own contact information. And if you have a question, you can always just ask them or report something that you think is suspicious. That's the best way to go about it.
I'm talking to Justin Levitt, professor of law at Loyola Marymount University, where he specializes in constitutional and election law. Now, Justin, as voting gets underway in many states, there's been some reports of groups, mostly of Trump supporters, who have said they'll show up at the polls on Election Day. Now, we can't predict, obviously, what will happen, but it seems the intention here might be to intimidate. So what does California law say about this?
It says you can't do that either. Showing up at the polls is fine. Watching is fine. Observing is fine. Taking notes is fine. But setting out to impede, interfere, or interrupt the normal process of voting is explicitly not fine. That language actually is language I've just quoted from the election statutes. And so when watching or observing turns into intimidation or interference, that's when it becomes unlawful.
Now, as in years past, poll watchers will be stationed at every vote center in the state. Those are regular people who observe sites to make sure that there are no shenanigans going on. In California, they do not have to sign up or be vetted by an official. But Justin, they're limited in any actions they can take at any site. What can they do and what can they not do?
So watching is fine. Mm-hmm. Taking notes is fine. If they see problems, reporting it to somebody else, including election officials, is fine. And you'll find people, by the way, who are doing this in order to help voters, people who are looking for problems with disability access, people who are looking for problems with language access, people who want to make sure that the signage around the polling place is as it should be, people who are watching to make sure that the polling process is smooth. And you'll also find people who are doing this not necessarily for individual voters, but to safeguard the integrity of the system. And all of that is fine, as long as it's not interfering with the actual election process, with the process of voting. Somebody cannot come up to you and challenge you personally. Somebody can't interfere with your ability to vote. Somebody can't electioneer. They can't talk to you about voting for or against a candidate or measure within 100 feet of the polling place. And so it really is a look but don't touch rule that as long as individuals aren't getting in the way, yeah, it's part of the civic process to be able to see how elections are going. The moment they get in the way, election officials have full authority to ensure that they don't pose a problem.
You know, people have seen pictures recently of people in other states carrying weapons, firearms, while near a polling place. But the law in California is clear on that. What does the law here in California say on that?
Yeah, and I should, a note of caution, by the way, one picture sometimes from years ago can spark a lot of anxiety about what may be happening near you now. So be careful about the information you get, and as always, assume that some of the information you get may be old or outdated or in a different place or exaggerated. California is very clear that you may not have a firearm at the polls. There are exceedingly limited exceptions for somebody who's a private guard arranged by the county, or somebody who's a police officer conducting official business and just there to vote and not do anything else. But beyond that, there's really a flat ban. No firearms in California at the polls, period, unless the city or county has authorized you to be there. And that, too, that's a pretty stiff fine and potentially a felony charge.
One more thing, Jess. I mean, with all these different concerns popping up, this election might be ramping up people's concerns and worries. But as an elections expert, what do you expect to see in California?
I expect to see a lot of nerves and a lot of anxiety based on a lot of noise in the national narrative. And I expect to see the process be relatively smooth in California. It may be a little different this year, as everything is a little different this year because of the pandemic. But voters who check their voter registration, who make a plan to vote, whether they're going to vote by mail or in person, including lots of early voting periods, and those who take advantage of those opportunities early will actually see, I think, an overwhelmingly smooth response to the polls. It's really important for people not to let the national noise translate to their own polling place. I think this election is going to be a lot smoother than a lot of people think.
Justin Levitt, professor of law at Loyola Marymount University. Justin, thank you very much.
Of course.
More Take Two coming right up. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and most places you get your podcasts. I'm Amy Martinez. Today is Indigenous Peoples Day in Los Angeles, the third year LA County has celebrated the official holiday. The county is one of several cities and states across the country that have decided to replace Columbus Day with the holiday celebrating the history and culture of Native American people. Yet, with an election less than a month away, Native Americans across the U.S. are still experiencing obstacles when it comes to casting a ballot. Professor at Claremont Graduate University, Jean Schrodel, recently wrote a book on the topic called Voting in Indian Country, The View from the Trenches. Jean, let's start with some historical context, because I know it's not easy, but can you try to lay out a brief timeline from citizenship to voting rights for the indigenous community here in the U.S.?
Okay, very quickly. Yeah. After the end of the Civil War, the Reconstruction Amendments, 13, 14, 15th Amendments, they explicitly did not apply to the indigenous people in this country. The Supreme Court in the early 1880s went so far as to say that Native people in this country could never become citizens. That, of course, changed when the United States actually needed manpower, or in some cases, woman power to some extent, in the First World War. And in particular, after the war, individuals who had fought were given U.S. citizenship. Then in 1924, that expanded to encompass all American Indian / Alaska Native people born within the boundaries of the United States. This was the Indian Citizenship Act. It was an act of Congress as opposed to the Constitution. But with citizenship, that did not bring with it voting rights. Wow. At the time the ICA was passed, five or six states explicitly precluded Native people from being able to vote. Now, those particular provisions were made unconstitutional by the passage of the ICA. At that point, a number of these states, actually a majority of the states, that had large Native populations, passed laws very much akin to what was going on in the South, laws that dealt with literacy, laws that dealt with being able to speak English. They also had some unique ones that said, okay, if you're going to maintain an identity with your tribal nation, you can't vote. So you have to self-terminate. So it was a really hard, hard issue. And we come forward, we hit the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And most of us go, yay, VRA, change everything. No. In fact, sorry, many, many people did not think the Voting Rights Act applied to the indigenous people of this country.
That's amazing.
It is,
isn't it? Yeah, no, it is. It absolutely is that they have to go through that much and jump that many hoops to try and get something that should be theirs by birthright. Now, your book focuses on voting rights and challenges tribal communities face across the country. So let's zero in on California for a second. Can you tell us what obstacles Native Americans face in this state?
Okay, it's an interesting state because California has not had a voting rights case involving Native Americans. It's interesting in that sense, but what we have here, there are some issues. And in fact, the Native American Voting Rights Coalition, which is a national body, includes the ACLU, Native American Rights Fund, North American Congress of American Indians, and a whole body of left-wing progressive groups, held hearings across the United States to uncover what kinds of barriers that Native people faced in different states. And it was really interesting because there were hearings held in both Northern California, up in the Sacramento area, and down here in Southern California, there was a hearing held outside of San Diego. And what came out of those hearings was really interesting because people had not been looking at California. And what we found is there were testimony that individuals came. So in Southern California, people from the San Lucendo and the San Jacinto Mountains, they spoke about having to travel an hour and 20 minutes in order to vote, that they were up on the top of this mountain and they had to come all the way down from the mountain to be able to vote. We also got testimony from Northern California, the Curac, who are located, their reservation is just south of the Oregon border. They told us that they had to travel 80 miles if they wanted to vote. And it was on treacherous roads that, in fact, in 2016, the roads were blocked for an entire month due to heavy snowfall, and they were locked in. So there's some issues in California that haven't gotten much notice.
What about vote by mail, especially this year, when voting by mail is getting a lot of attention amid the pandemic? What barriers do Native American communities face there?
Oh, thank you for that question, A. That's a great question. Because California has been in the forefront, one of the states in the forefront of voting by mail. But most people who live on reservations, I can't say 100% of reservations across the entire United States, but most of them do not actually have home mail delivery. So you or I, or at least for me, I can say I step a couple steps outside my door to get my mail. You have people who have to travel to post offices. So then it becomes an issue of how far away are your post offices? Let me give you an example, if you will. Arizona, you have the Navajo Nation. Uh-huh. Navajo Nation, part of it goes over into New Mexico and into Utah, but most of it is in Arizona. Mm-hmm. It is larger than the state of West Virginia. West Virginia has 725 post offices. Navajo Nation has 40 places where people can vote. And a chunk of those are not full post offices, but little things in gas stations and mini marts.
So a difference of about 600 is, or almost 700, really.
Yeah. Wow. But it, you know, for example, on one part on the reservation, it's an area called Denehatso, Mexican Water, and Rock Point. It's 871 square miles without a single post office. And we're talking about people who, in many cases, are poor.
That's quite a terrible legacy that we have. Another chapter in that terrible legacy America has with Native people. That's Gene Schrodel, the Thornton F. Bradshaw Professor of Public Policy at Claremont Graduate University, author of Voting in Indian Country, The View from the Trenches. Gene, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, speaking of voting, LeBron James yesterday and today could have been talking a lot about his fourth NBA Finals MVP, his fourth championship, third with a different city. There's a lot of stuff he could have been talking about on social media. Instead, he was talking about voting yesterday and today. Find out why when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and on kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. When Lakers won their 17th NBA title last night, it ended a season altered by the pandemic and impacted by the country's reckoning around race and social justice. LeBron James, who is leading a Get Out the Vote campaign off the court, was awarded the Most Valuable Player trophy, but he didn't really talk basketball in his remarks.
We know we all want to see better days, and when we leave here, we got to continue to push that, continue to push social injustice, continue to push for voter suppression, continue to push for police brutality, continue to push for everything that's the opposite of love. And I think if we can continue to do that, all of us, America would be a much better place, which we all love this country.
Yeah, it seems activism in sports is louder than ever this year. Earlier in the playoffs, Milwaukee Bucks boycotted a game in protest over the police shooting of Jacob Blake, and the WNBA devoted their season to Breonna Taylor. Richard Lapchick is president of the Institute for Sport and Social Justice at the University of Central Florida. He says things have really changed since 2016.
When Colin Kaepernick took a knee in 2016, I think most sports fans opposed it. I think public opinion ran against him. The most recent Nielsen report on sports fans and racism showed that sports fans are overwhelmingly supporting athlete activism. They're supporting teams and leagues supporting athletes, and they're even asking their brands to get involved with social justice issues. So I think there's been an enormous shift in public opinion, but I think when the Bucks stepped off the court, or I guess never get on the court in the bubble in the playoffs, that for me was one of the most important events that had taken place since Tommy Smith and John Carlos in the 1960s and Muhammad Ali refusing to go to Vietnam in the 1960s. Carlos and Smith didn't get employed for the next 7 years. Ali's faced 5 years in jail. Any athlete that took an action in the interim period had serious consequences against them in their professional career. Kaepernick, when he took a knee, I told my wife that this will be his last season, and it was. Mm-hmm. But now with leagues, teams, and individual athletes getting involved in unison, it's a completely different landscape that we have today. And for athletes who've been asked about, do you think you're going to recover from your injury? Do you think the team will make the playoffs? Do you think you'll win the championship? To now being asked about racism, about social justice issues in general, being asked as fully dimensional human beings, it's a really good feeling for the first time to be valued in that way, not just for your bodies and what you could do as an athlete, but what you can do and contribute as a human being. So I think this level is not going to be reversed. We're going to continue to see athlete activism. It's going to build and expand its base to include things like, you know, who's managing and coaching our teams, which is overwhelmingly white men. Who's covering us in the press box? It's overwhelmingly still white men.
Richard, you mentioned how the Milwaukee Bucks deciding not to play a basketball game a few months ago was one of the most significant actions of sports activism that you can remember since John Carlos and Tommy Smith raised their fists up at the Olympics on the medal stand. I always think back, though, to Muhammad Ali. If I'm thinking about what athletes sacrificed the most more than anyone else, Muhammad Ali, who gave up the prime years of his athletic career to protest the Vietnam War, not wanting to go to Vietnam and fight, as someone who really actually sacrificed something. When it comes to the Milwaukee Bucks, what did they have on the line?
Well, they had on the line their salaries for the rest of the year. They had on the line the possibility of ending the NBA season. You know, the NBA immediately fell in line with the Bucks within an hour, as did the Players Association. There was no guarantee that the season would be resumed if that had happened. We wouldn't have had an NBA Finals. We wouldn't have a Los Angeles Lakers championship again. And who knows what would have happened in terms of fan bases, corporate support. You know, the NBA has long been considered the most progressive of all the leagues, but all the other leagues are also involved in social activism in this particular period. So I think if that season had stopped at that point, we don't know what would have happened. But in terms of the long term viability of professional sports leagues, it definitely would have been an injury to that future had the leagues not decided a couple of days later to resume.
Richard, when it comes to LeBron James, mentioned earlier his voting activism on his Twitter feed, what power of influence do you think that LeBron has in general on any issue that he decides to amplify?
I think LeBron is the most respected athlete of his generation, not only because of what he does on the court, but what he's consistently stood for in the community. You know, it's not only talking about issues. LeBron started his school in Akron as a, you know, national model of possibility. He's been consistent. He's been vocal. He's been clear in his messaging. He's been the victim of, you know, he had racial epithets painted on his gate in Los Angeles several years ago. He's faced that. He's faced the same thing that other Black people fear when he sends his children out into the community. You know, are they going to be safe? And people are getting to understand that more and more. And I think LeBron, not only because of his playing, but because of his voice, as I said, is probably the most respected person in professional sports today or college sports, especially on these issues of social justice.
Richard, I ask this because it was kind of striking to me that this past season, when the NBA allowed players to put social justice slogans on their jersey, that LeBron did not have anything. He just had his last name on the back of his jersey. Some players had Black Lives Matter, others had Vote, some kind of pre-approved by the league social message. What did you make of LeBron James not taking part of that?
I think LeBron was saying that everybody knew that the NBA was doing what it was doing because of the actions of LeBron James and a handful of other players. And I think LeBron was saying that my whole life represents all the 25 phrases that are being worn on the back of jerseys and the Black Lives Matter emblem. And that because he embraced all those things and was a leadership, that he didn't have to do that.
Talking to Richard Lapchick, president of the Institute for Sport and Social Justice at the University of Central Florida. Now, each year, Richard, you write a series of reports on pro sports teams tracking the racial and gender equity inside the sports themselves. How would you rank the sports in terms of most equitable?
If you include women's sport, there's no question that WNBA is the best in terms of racial and gender hiring practices. If you just look at men's sport, once again, there's no question that the NBA is the leader. The other leagues have improved. We've been doing this since 1988, when the other leagues were all getting C's and C minuses. The other leagues have moved up and they're getting B's and B pluses and some A's in racial hiring practices. Where everybody is not doing as well is in gender hiring practices, including the NBA.
Why do you think, though, when it comes to the WNBA, you mentioned how they've really been the league to embrace activism above all the others, but it's always the men. It's always the men that draw the most attention, whether it's what they're doing or not doing. Why do you think there is that divide?
Well, you know, I think that we've gotten better at looking at racial issues in America. I don't think we've gotten great, but we've gotten better. But I think in terms of sexism and misogyny, we're still, you know, standing far behind the line of where we need to be. So we don't pay as much attention to a league like the WNBA. was delighted to see the WNBA television ratings were way up this year. And you probably saw that they were the only sports league, including all the men's leagues, that where the ratings have actually increased during the pandemic. I think that's a sign of hopefully of things to come, but we still have a long way to go. You know, we also do college racial and gender report cards, and the single most distressing statistic that we report among more than 100,000 statistics across all the report cards is this: women's college sports teams across all three divisions, 60% of women's teams are coached by men, and 50% of women's assistant coaches across all three divisions are men. Doesn't even make any sense that 48 years after the passage of Title IX that that's the case. But it is the case.
Where do you think this all goes, Richard? What sort of power and influence do you think athletes can have to affect meaningful change in our society going forward? Because we always think, oh, how much further can this go? And considering 2020 has been quite an extraordinary year, I'm wondering what would the next step be?
Well, you know, no matter what changes we see in sport, and I hope that athletes are going to help lead those changes, some of which we've talked about here this afternoon. You know, but the reality is that the discussions are about more than athlete activism, more than about police brutality. They're about systemic racism. And the one statistic that I think is going to be the hardest to overcome is the fact that the Forbes list of the 400 wealthiest Americans has an aggregate wealth greater than all 42 million African Americans combined. That affects housing, healthcare, education, the criminal justice system, the finance industry. That's a lot to overcome, and that's where so much focus needs to be addressed in the future.
That's Richard Lapchick, president of the Institute for Sport and Social Justice at the University of Central Florida. Richard, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, if you missed any part of Take Two, I mean, it was a really good show today. The best show we've done all week. Just go wherever you get your podcast there. We will be waiting to be heard by you. We're also on social media at Take Two. I'm there as well at A Martinez LA. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.